to it.
Okay.
My name is Henry David McCary. I'm 79 years of age and was born on July the 21st in the year 1891. A son of a northern Alabama sharecropper farmer. In December the 20th, 1907, I enlisted in the United States Army at Anniston, Alabama, and received my boot training at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. In the month of January 1908, I was shipped west and assigned to Company G of the 22nd Infantry stationed at the Presidio of Monterey, California. In the month of June 1908, the 22nd Infantry proceeded northward and relieved the 12th Infantry, who were guarding the far-flung borders of our nation in the territory of Alaska. Company G and Company M of the regiment, under the command of Captain Henry A. Hannigan, were assigned to Fort Egbert, and we arrived at Skagway on a troop transport and were transferred over the railroad up to White Horse, where we boarded a Yukon River steamer and proceeded down the river to Dawson. From Dawson, we continued down to the village of Eagle, where Fort Egbert was located at that time, and relieved two companies of the 12th Infantry. And taking over Fort Egbert at that time, the post had been completed, and the overall picture of Fort Egbert consisted of a two-story barracks, a headquarters building, a row of officers' quarters, I believe four or five officers' quarters, two stories in height. Headquarter building was two stories in height. The guardhouse was located across the parade ground, and it contained a watchtower where a sentry slowly walked around this watchtower. His duties consisted mostly of keeping a sharp lookout for a fire in a building, because we had no way of fighting a fire in the summertime except buckets of water, and in the winter with shovels and snow. As our first winter approached, the winter of 1909, the last boat down the Yukon from Dawson, two young officers came in on their first assignment from West Point. One of these officers was named Ray C. Hill, second lieutenant, and the officer with him was named Leslie L. Baer, B-A-H-R or B-H-E-R, I forgot which. These two young officers were carefully selected to conduct activities in the gymnasium, which is situated back of the barracks. This gymnasium at the time was well equipped, and all activities were conducted in the gymnasium except the necessary fatigue and guard duty. The two young officers were superb indoor gymnasts and led the men in physical drill every morning at 8 o'clock and followed through with lectures and so forth. Our winter uniforms were issued, I believe, in the month of either September or October, and consisted of two pairs of long fleece-lined underwear, and the trade name on this underwear was W-R-I-G-H-T, Wrights, fleece-lined underwear. We were issued a Mackinac uniform, a double-breasted coat with buttons about the size of a half a dollar, a special stocking that came up over the trousers' legs and fastened below the knee, a pair of felt shoes, a pair of moccasins, fur mittens, and a fur cap. And as I remember it, the men had a ball as they got into this winter uniform, kidding each other. As the winter wore on, these two young officers would frequently go to the dog corral and hitch up a team of huskies and go out hunting and return and 4 to 6 hours, bringing in one or two caribou, which they killed and dressed in the field, and these caribou would be fed to the men in the form of juicy caribou steaks smothered in mashed potatoes and gravy. I better get my thoughts together here a little now. So as far as the duty of the American soldier at Fort Egbert during our stay there, 1908 to 1910, consisted mostly of total leisure. Fort Egbert had been completed in all its building, and the guardhouse had a watchtower, probably 30 or 40 feet high, in which a sentry slowly walked around. And his orders were consisted mostly of keeping a sharp lookout for a fire in a building, because we had no way of fighting a fire in the summer except with buckets of water, and in the winter with shovels and snow. Now, it so happened that I had my 16th birthday at Fort Egbert, July 21st, 1908. I was a bugler in Company G, and sounded all calls, beginning at first call each morning at 6 o'clock, and then assembly and a mess call and a reveille in which the flag was raised, on through the day until the bugle call of taps at 11 p.m. And my duties consisted of being bugler of the guard every fourth night. There were two buglers to each company, and as we rotated on guard duty, and naturally I was a bugler of the guard every fourth night and slept at the guardhouse with my uniform on. During these 2 years as a bugler, I lived in a world of pure fantasy. At night, in sounding the last call of the day, taps, I would see a window in the back sometime open, and a man would stick his head out and listen. And in those days, the bugler who could do that was considered pretty good. The notes of the bugle seemed to bounce off of the granite walls of Eagle Bluff, which appeared to be about 1,000 yards from the Fort Egbert. And the notes of the bugle would then circle out over the frozen Yukon, back around over the frozen pine forest, and I could count the echoing notes of this bugle as many as 5 times. And being a 16 years of age and at the impressionable age of youth, at times there, I actually believed that I was communicating with things like angels with harps. Or perhaps the notes of the bugle were searching the universe for the soul of some soldier who died in battle and was never heard from. Our leisure time was conducted mostly in a gymnasium. Back of the barracks, there was a gymnasium large enough for a regulation basketball court, and many of the men spent the afternoons and evenings in there developing their various skills on the horizontal parallel bars, side horse and Roman ranks, boxing and wrestling, and basketball games would frequently take place between Company G and Company M. One of the big things in the leisure time was during the summer, news had spread that a boat was coming down from Yukon or up the river, and men would go down the riverbank to watch these boats come and go. Boats coming down from Dawson had to sweep around a bend in the river, flags flying and smoke billowing from the smokestacks, painted white, was one beautiful thing to see, appearing as graceful swans. The last boat of the season usually came down from Dawson, making a last desperate effort to make the run down river before being caught in an ice jam. And as the boat tied up at Eagle, it would hurry and scurry as freight was unloaded and loaded. Then they'd disappear down the river with a stern wheel hitting the chunks of floating ice in the river and making considerable noise. We had a murder, or a suicide, rather, Private Wilson of Company G, an old-time professional soldier, got drunk and shot himself with his own rifle. Our water supply at Fort Egbert in that time was obtained from Mission Creek, a mile or so from the barracks, and this water was brought in during the winter with tanks on sleds pulled by horses. Out at this tank house along Mission Creek, there was a bunkhouse out there, and a detail was maintained there consisting of a cook and a corporal, usually a corporal in charge, was three or four or five privates. And at this bunkhouse, a crab game operated for two solid years. The only way, I mean this poker game, you can limit. A poker game operated at this so-called tank house, or bunkhouse along Mission Creek, and the only way you could get a seat into this poker game was to go out there and find out when some player was going to leave the game and be there and take his place. On the way out to this bunkhouse, there was a cemetery where several military were buried among tall trees. And we had a man in Company G by the name of Barnes. Barnes was the butt of all jokes, but he had a way of getting back at his tormentors to his own advantage. Knowing exactly what time he was going to walk out this road past this cemetery, the men thought they would pull a classical joke on Private Barnes and have something to laugh about. They took several bed sheets and went out there and erected a ghost at this graveyard, and then took their place behind trees across the road to wait until Private Barnes came by. As he came along, he was whistling, and he saw this ghost and stopped and studied it for a moment. Then he walked over and removed the sheets, carefully folded them, placed them in his pocket, and went on out to the end of the poker game. The next day, as everyone wondered what Private Barnes was going to do about it, in the afternoon, he went through quarters, lifting up the blankets of each bunk, trying to find the numbers of bed sheets that corresponded with the ones that the ghost was made out of. This Private Barnes did something that might be of interest. One night during the winter, a terrific snowstorm occurred, and the wind blew and whipped up great piles of snow around the corner of the barracks. And as the men came out studying these beautiful snowdrifts, Private Barnes came out of quarters, stark naked, ran down the porch of barracks and dived headlong, executing a beautiful swan dive into one of these snowbanks. Disappeared in a fluff of snow, and the men gathered around. They were yelling, "We better rescue Private Barnes, he'll smother in there." In a moment or so, Private Barnes, crawling on his hands and knees, stuck his head out of the snowbank and yelled, "Hey, fellas, you can breathe in here." I'm going to relate something here that I rather hesitate to do, but it occurred, and I will relate it. Back in those days, the American soldier was a different breed from what we see today. As a matter of fact, anyone could get in the Army. No questions were asked, or his background was not investigated. An ex-convict could very well enlist in the Army with no questions asked. As for the enlisted personnel of the 22nd Infantry, they were mostly consisted of professional soldiers. This regiment at the time was considered one of the elite units of the United States Army. The regiment had served 2 years as a legation guard in China, and it had served 2 years in the Philippine Islands. While in the States, It often paraded in a uniform of blue, and the regiment sported a 45-piece military band. This regiment could execute what they called a bus manual, a drill using a rifle, something like you would use a Maple 1 in a gymnastic drill. And this was timed to music. At Fort Sam Houston, where this regiment was stationed after its tour at Fort Egbert or throughout Alaska, the regiment rendezvoused at Fort Sam Houston and went back again to these amazing parades, like files on parade. This regiment would turn out dressed in blue uniform, white gloves, polished shoes, polished brass button, with a full dress cord that went around the neck and through the shoulder strap on the left shoulder, and with tassels that hung down. These dress cords were universally used in the military. Infantry were blue, cavalry yellow, and artillery red. And 1,000 of people would come out from San Antonio and line the parade ground and watch this regiment perform the bus manual as their 45-piece military band played music. Now, with that type of man stationed in Alaska, there was one thing that they did not tolerate. Regardless of what a soldier in those days would do on payday, he would visit the red light district, and then that was that. But there's one thing he did not tolerate in his midst, and that was a sexual deviant of any kind. Therefore, it came to pass that in Company G, we had a private named Adams. Adams, during the winter of 1909, I believe, made a few passes of some of the men. And as a result of this, one night, Private Adams was taken down a foot trail back of the barracks to Mission Creek, to where Mission Creek flows into the Yukon. And at that point, these men either chopped a hole in the ice or Eagle Creek had honeycombed the Yukon into a condition which Private Barnes could be done away with. Anyway, at that spot where Eagle Mission Creek at that time was called Eagle Creek, today it is called Mission Creek, where Mission Creek flows into the Yukon, Private Barnes was murdered. The next morning, they seated at the mess table in the mess hall. Private Barnes was absent. Many rumors spread about what had happened to him. Some of the men claimed he went with an old sourdough down a river and was living in a cabin. But the fact remained that Private Barnes was simply done away with, and his grave became the Yukon River. This man was carried on the morning report, as the Army regulations required at that time, for 10 days as missing, as absent without leave, and then his name was dropped from the payroll as missing, whereabouts unknown. No investigation was ever made of this, and it simply became a closed chapter at Fort Egbert. Regarding the educational opportunities at Fort Egbert, a school was held in the second story of the headquarters building every Friday night, and every man who did not have a high school education was required to attend. These schools were conducted by young lieutenants, particularly Lieutenant Hill and Lieutenant Bear. Maybe we better check out here a little now. A mail delivery at Fort Egbert during our days in service there in 1908 and 1910. A mail came down from Dawson one time each week. In the wintertime, it was brought down by horse and sled. And whenever this mail arrived, regardless of what hour, the bugler of the guard was required to sound mail call and a man from each barracks would come in to the headquarters building and get the mail for his particular company. And it was unusual indeed. In fact, it created quite a bit of comment when an enlisted man received a letter from home in those days. As far as a furlough, it was unknown. You simply served your 3 years, 24 hours each day. However, in those days, if something did occur in a man's family, a tragedy, a death of a father or mother, the officers, the military officers of those days, were most considerate. In fact, some of them were known to take money from their own pocket to give a man a leave of absence so he could return to his family. While at Fort Egbert, something quite unusual occurred. We witnessed the Malamute dog swim the Yukon. In checking this over with the men at Eagle a few days ago, which would be around June the 24th, the old-timers there stated they had never seen this. However, we witnessed one Malamute dog during our stay there swim the Yukon from the far side over to the village. Now, we come to the winter of 1909, probably the month of January, February, or March, when the Northern Lights put on a spectacular display which simply overwhelmed everyone. This particular night, as I remembered, the man on walking in a watchtower over the guardhouse blew down through a speaking tube which connected the sentry overhead with the sergeant down below at his desk. And he yelled down through the speaking tube, "Sergeant, look outside. The world is coming to an end." I was bugler of the guard that night, and all the sentries rushed outside, and the Northern Lights appeared to be coming down close to earth and forming over the Yukon River. As time went on, men began coming out of barracks, and officers and their wives began coming out of their quarters, and finally, the entire military personnel of Fort Egbert were out on the parade ground, mingling together on common ground with all ranks suspended. This display of the Northern Lights were so spectacular that, and so awe-inspiring that as the men talked to the officers' wives, including the wife of our commanding officer, Captain H.A. Hannigan, under ordinary circumstances, an enlisted man speaking to an officer's wife would mean a guardhouse confinement. However, this night, as I remembered, the men stood there simply unbelieving. If you walked along, the colors were dancing in patterns on the snow, and it made you dizzy. I can also remember some of the things that our commanding officer, Captain Henry A. Hannigan, said to us as we gathered around him, apparently, as I remember, for protection against some unknown catastrophic thing that might occur. That was the feeling that this amazing display of the Northern Lights were staging. And as we gathered around Captain Hannigan, he said, "This amazing display of the aurora borealis we're witnessing here tonight can probably be seen to the tip end of Florida and into the state of Maine. And it's possible that it could be in some way associated with the approach of Halley's Comet, which we shall shortly see right over our heads." Well, we did witness Halley's Comet. Standing on the parade ground for 3 nights, we could see this Halley's Comet moving across the earth. A very spectacular view indeed. Now, I might finish this memory of my 2 years at Fort Egbert. I suppose I've forgotten many things that occurred there. The regiment left for Alaska in 1910 and made rendezvous at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, where I was discharged. At that moment, Captain Hannigan called me to his office and advised me to reenlist, stating that I was unprepared for civilian life. Then if I would reenlist in his company, he would promote me to the rank of sergeant. I accepted this proposition from Captain Hannigan and reenlisted and served 3 more years. And then in 1914, I was discharged and headed for Hollywood, California, and began working in the RKO studios in Hollywood at that time. The war in Europe broke out, and the government sent out a call for application to officer training camps. And I applied and was accepted and graduated from the first officer training camp held at Presidio, San Francisco, as a first lieutenant, and was assigned to the 63rd Infantry. And due to my athletic ability, I suppose, which I had learned in the gymnasium at Fort Egbert, I was made athletic officer of the 63rd Infantry. The war terminated, and I again returned to Hollywood. And finding that I was prepared for no particular career, I fell back on my 2 years of training under Lieutenant Hill and Lieutenant Barrett Fort Egbert, in which I had become a pretty good all-around gymnast, knowing the nomenclature and so forth of the various athletic apparatus, such as the horizontal, parallel, side, parallel bars, side horse, and Roman rings, and tumbling and so forth. So I decided to rely upon that and make my career as a physical ed teacher. I was a physical director at the Hollywood Athletic Club when that opened up, quite a swanky, where the movie stars gathered and conditioned their bodies, steam baths, and took exercise in the gymnasium. Later, I was athletic director at the Jonathan Club, one of the best-known social clubs west of Chicago. The reason I mention this is the fact that my career actually was created and perfected at Fort Egbert in the gymnasium back of the barracks, which I made quite a success, combining what I had learned at Fort Egbert in the gymnasium there with summer courses at USC and UCLA and teaching gymnastics. After the war, I read an article about Captain Hannigan. Captain Hannigan is quite a remarkable officer. He had risen from the ranks and referred to the men under his command as my boys and treated them accordingly. After the war, I read an article in the Los Angeles Times where Captain Hannigan, now a colonel, was in command of the California National Guard with headquarters in Los Angeles. I got out my first lieutenant uniform and went to down in the city of Los Angeles, took the elevator up to his office, and as I opened the door, Captain Hannigan, now wearing eagles on his shoulders instead of captain bars, sitting behind a desk, he had grayed considerably. I walked up in front of him in my uniform and clicked my heels together and saluted him. The colonel got up and studied me for a moment and returned the salute, and then he embraced me, and then he said, my bugler, my sergeant, and now I see that our government has bestowed upon you the greatest honor any government can bestow upon one of its citizens, a commission in its armed forces. And no government could exist without men like you. Lindbergh had just flown the Atlantic, and papers were screaming headlines about it. And the Los Angeles Times, with one of these headlines about this Lindbergh flight to Paris, was laying on his desk, and I asked the colonel what he thought about it. And I can repeat the exact words that this military man answered when I asked this question. He said Lindbergh did not do that alone. He had a co-pilot, and his co-pilot was God. Now, this flight from the United States to Paris does not mean anything to this present generation, but it will mean a great deal to future generations as nations struggle for the mastery of the earth. Regarding Lieutenant Hill, who was practically an idol among the men at Fort Egbert, as the war went on, I was stationed at Camp Meade, Maryland, and I had to go to brigade headquarters one day, and while standing inside waiting to see someone, a horse came tearing up, reared up on his hind legs, and an officer swung off of this horse and threw the bridles to an orderly and came inside, and it was Lieutenant Hill, now holding the rank of major. I had the pleasure of greeting Hill at this time, and he too complimented me on it and referred to Fort Egbert. And he said, "In the gymnasium up there, as I watched you, I knew you had something in you. Congratulations, Lieutenant. Carry on," he said, and away he went. Regarding our duties at Fort Egbert, the only time we were exposed to the elements was during target practice. In the winter time, we were taken out in details at a time, probably 30 or 40 men up to the target range where the trees had been cleared out and a target range had been established, 600 yards long. A huge fire would be built at the 600-yard point in this target range. A man's name would be called. He would take his place at the along a firing line, wearing his fatigue parka, which was lined with lamb's wool. He'd lie down in the snow and fire five shots. Then he would run as hard as he could down to 500 yards, lie down and fire five shots. He would duplicate this at 400 yards and then run to 200 yards from the target and fire five shots standing up. In order to fire our rifles, we had to remove our fur mittens. And by the time we got to the 200-yard distance and fired our five shots, the men could not feel the trigger of their rifle with their finger. It was due to the weather, probably 40 or 50 below. Then we would race back to the fire as fast as we could and warm up. As I previously stated, Captain Hannigan referred to the men under him as my boys and treated them accordingly. So in doing these skirmish runs and target practice, Captain Hannigan saw to it that the men had a huge fire to warm, and they were taken to the target range in detail so they did not have to wait around. As soon as you finished your 600-yard skirmish run...